you all very much. I appreciate the group coming over from Ethos to spend some time here. You've given me great face, and I'm grateful for that. I've introduced and keynoted many conferences over my career. I've never keynoted two conferences at the same time. And I got to tell you, it's a challenge. When I was invited to the COIN conference, I wasn't sure exactly why I was being invited to begin with. I've gradually come to see, but it was a malicious, mischievous idea you had to do that. But I also realized the connection with Ethos is pretty serious, and I have many friends over on that side, Terry and John and so forth. But the challenge of bringing these together is pretty great. I come at this not from the geeky side, although there has been a lot of discussion of engineering and software development on the one side. I am not exactly a graphic designer, though I've worked in a variety of communication design problems over my career. So I'm trying to think, how do I blend these things together? And I finally decided that what I have never done before is explain why I've gone to the Weatherhead School of Management. And I realized that is very relevant to what these two conferences are about. So I'm going to indulge myself in a little bit of a personal story. And maybe this personal story will have some connection for you and then also for the conference themes, because I'm deeply interested in the themes of both sides of this conference. And it turns out that my migration to the Weatherhead is relevant. I'm a professor of design, management, and information systems. That's a mouthful. And going into a business environment, well, wait a minute. We don't have a business school. We're a school of management. And that's different. That's significantly different. And I'll try to explain that in a minute. But let me tell you how I got to go there. I began my work in areas of communication design and industrial design, teaching some. I taught in the Department of Visual Communication at the Art Institute of Chicago and other places. When I went to Carnegie Mellon, I had to combine together an interest in communication design and industrial design, because we had two strong groups in those areas, really powerful groups. While there, the groups discovered interaction design, the third great field of design practice in our time. The third great field. Its significance continues to unroll tremendously, but Carnegie Mellon had one of the first, if not the first, interaction program in the world, and I felt very pleased and proud about that. And you have to understand that interaction design comes from the concern for information and communication within what's called graphic design. More effectively, I think, termed communication design, but that's a quibble. It takes the information and communication through signs, symbols, images, and combines that with the whole body experience understood by the industrial designer. This is Bill Verplank's notion to combine these two, that this is the way to explain what we do in interaction, and he's right. Bill is always a wise and insightful man, and he caught it this time too, because interaction design needs the other forms of design practice. But what happens is that those forms are transformed. They're transformed in that what used to be a small part of graphic design, a little concern for timetables, called information design, suddenly expands and becomes the medium of human interaction. Information is the flow that connects us together. That transcends the older limitations of information. The whole body experience is tricky in this. Now, during my time at Carnegie Mellon and other places, I have to say, I encountered lots of folks who like to live on flatland. They lived on the computer screen. Whoa, I've got one staring me right here. They lived on flatland. And they thought the way humans related to computers was through interfaces. And now their idea of an interface, you have to understand this. Interface, you can only use that word if you have two things facing each other. And to have them facing each other, they've got to be things. But you know, suppose you don't think of this as a conflict or a bumping of things. Suppose a human being is not just a thing, but it's something else, more complex and rich, something deserving another kind of respect. That's where we transformed interface into true human interaction. We talk about transactions of people. We talk about the human interactions of people. But we get off of flatland. The computer screen is only effective as it supports the interaction of people. Interaction design is the study of how people relate to other people through the mediation of products. We're mediating right now through this little fellow and those bright lights in this room and that camera that's shining its light at me. We're interacting through those mediated elements around us. So this is where I think the idea of the whole body experience is terribly significant. We have gotten away from the concerns for flat land. Some people still have to worry about those, and it's thank God they do. I'm really glad. But the problems of design lie elsewhere. And in fact, as we developed it at Carnegie Mellon, as we've seen it unfold in many other places, interaction is not fundamentally about interaction with computers. I'm sorry for our friends in computer science. They like to think it is. And we had a group at Carnegie Mellon that was big on this. They call it the Human-Computer Interaction Institute, and that's fine, HCI. But, you know, most interactions are not about computer interactions. It's a small part of our lives. When you start to realize that we might design the way human beings interact in all sorts of situations, we might give thought to how people relate together. Not letting it happen by chance, serendipity, or the whims of circumstance. We might be thoughtful about how we get together and do things together. When you start to form that idea, you're in another world. Now, one of the spin-offs of this is what we call, most recently, service design. And, in fact, 3 or 4 years ago, we had the first service design conference in the United States. In fact, we had two of them. Shelley Evanson played a nice role in that, and she deserves a lot of respect for that. Service design has sprung up all around the world. I was in the Far East not too long ago and learned about a program already under firm development in Seoul. Excellent program, good thought, run by a Japanese designer. Interesting. But service also is only a part of the picture of what we're trying to develop around interaction. The more I worked with interaction, the more I realized I was not concerned simply with the interaction of one person and one person, individual interactions. I became increasingly interested in collective interactions. How we interact in groups, in communities, in organizations. So in fact, one of the last courses I created at Carnegie Mellon was called Design, Management, and Organizational Change. And it came about for this reason. We had a group of students who performed and developed an excellent product idea for the city of Pittsburgh. It was terrific, wonderful work. They went down to City Hall and they presented their work. City Council thought it was wonderful. President of the Council, everyone applauded. Just great stuff. So come out to lunch with us. Took the students to lunch. My God, what guys they are. They were all guys. They were really nice. But the president of the council leaned over to the students, to one student at one point, and he said, you know, this was really a great project, but you know, it'll never get built. We'll never implement it. Student was shocked. Stunned. How do you do brilliant work and not have an impact in the world? Well, the students came back and told the story. And as I began to understand what had happened, I realized that we needed to do more for the students to prepare them to interact effectively in organizations. Hence the course that I taught, which, by the way, is probably a better MBA course than they have in most business schools. You should see the reading list. When I show it to my colleagues in other business schools, their jaws drop. Designers can read that and understand it. You bet your life they can. That was significant for me. But the further I worked at collective interactions or helping students understand how to move into organizations and effect change, the more projects I did related to that. An example, I worked on a group to redesign the taxation system of Australia. The taxation system of Australia, for goodness sake. That's a big project. It's still underway, by the way. the big multi-million dollar project with the Postal Service, truly an interaction project and product development. The more I did those projects and began to be visited by colleagues from business schools and management schools, I began to realize that maybe there was another challenge for design. There was another hot spot that we might move into and start to make a difference. And so for me, they've been after me for about 5 years at Weatherhead, and finally I thought, maybe now is the time. So I went there to a very different kind of environment, an environment in which two themes are central, design and sustainability, and we are essentially teaching MBA students to understand design and to practice it. Now, listen carefully to this distinction, because there are two parts to this kind of mission that we have. On the one hand, it's important that people who are going to run organizations understand what graphic and industrial design are all about. Understand product development, understand, at least appreciate the working efforts, and maybe contribute to that. That's got to improve operations in any case. But that's fairly traditional, and I get bored easily with traditional, and I didn't go there to do that primarily. I went there to teach a new kind of design student how to make a difference in the world. In fact, 20% of our incoming MBAs now are designers, have design backgrounds, and our target is 30%, 35%. Already, all of my PhD students have serious design background at Frog or other design houses. But the focus is to use design thinking to change the way organizations are. Oh, is that ambitious enough? It's as ambitious as your goals, Terry. My God. Not a small challenge. So I spend a lot of my time thinking about what is it that graphic designers and industrial designers and interaction designers, what is it about what they know, what concepts and what methods do they use that could be imported into this new environment? Understand, no longer in what I call the first or second orders of design, but now the third and fourth orders. Designing actions, processes, environments, organizations. To understand the importance of this, I mentioned that at the beginning of June, I had a meeting with a group from the UN. We met in Long Island to discuss uses of design in UN operations. It was the Institute for Disarmament, and they were interested in conflict resolution, where soldiers had been fighting, typically teenagers and younger, fighting in conflicts in Africa or elsewhere. And when the conflict is over, how do you bring those people back into civil society? And, oh my God, how do you bring them back if there is no civil society? How do you create one that they can live in and function in without shooting a gun? Not a small problem. But even there, the uses of design to affect how people live together and interact together are already significant. At that UN conference, we had a very senior UN officer, the man who coordinated all UN efforts in Bosnia and all UN efforts in Uganda. A very estimable man, I must say, a very impressive man, just retired. When we finished our two-day workshop, I turned to him and I said, what are you going to do now? You've retired. They'll want you to come and consult, I'm sure, because you know so darn much about how things work. What are you going to do? He stood for a second. He looked at me and he said, I'm going to devote myself the rest of my career to bringing design thinking into the United Nations. In just these kinds of practical, on-the-deck problems. Now, I won't tell you the details of how we prototyped a solution, but I'll tell you this, that for people who had no familiarity with design, and I have to say, in this group of 20, there were probably four or five serious designers. There was someone from LiveWork and myself and a couple of others. But in this group, people who had never thought about design exactly, and were skeptical, I must say, skeptical. It must be posters and toasters or niceness or something that's not... No. Tough, hard-edged people. Designers can deal with tough problems. The wicked problems. And I was quite touched by that. I was moved by that. It gave me some encouragement. I don't know how much they understand about design. God, it's a tough thing for any of us if we spend a lot of our lives in these schools and practices. But these people are trying. And we can give them tools, concepts, and methods that can make a difference in people's lives. I was in Seoul maybe 10 years ago for, was it 10 years? There was an IGSID meeting, the International Congress of Societies of Industrial Design. Mouthful. I went to an IGSID meeting, and we're sitting in the big building, the design center in Seoul, up about 10 floors. We looked out the window. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we saw hundreds of yellow buses converging on this building. Oh my God, it's X-Files or something. This is going to be crazy. The buses all parked, and out of it came children with white shirts and trousers or skirts, and it was like Children of the Corn or something. And they came closer to the building, and they came into the building and went up into the building. And we finally realized what was happening, that in Korea, there's a great value for people to know about design, even if they don't become practicing designers. Now, one of the graybeards from IGSID said, oh my God, there aren't that many design jobs in Korea. There aren't that many design jobs in all of Southeast Asia. But other wise heads said, bullshit. That's a technical term. I can show you the philosophic reference on that, so don't worry. It's been bullshit. I said, there's no problem with having as many students in design programs as we can get. Because as they understand design, they can make a difference within their organizations, their businesses. Well, I think that's certainly true, and that point just illustrates what I'm getting at. But at this Seoul conference, we did a survey of all the industrial design students there. We said, what kind of work do you want to do in the future? Guess what? Only a third of them wanted to make artifacts. Only one third. Two thirds saw the use of their art in some other aspect of life. What do you make of that? How do you interpret that? How do you support and further that meaning? Well, that's why I've gone to Weatherhead. Because I'm interested in collective interactions, how people work together to create innovations and benefit organizations and the people served by organizations. But here's the problem that I've run into, and it's a tough problem too. Is this working? Oh, it is. My God, I can hear my own echo. I'm tired of being back there. I've come down here, but it's not so easy either. Here's the trick on this. Right now, the idea of design and business or management coming together is a really hot spot. By luck in my career, I've fallen into hot spots, and I've now fallen into another hot spot because it's a big deal all over the world. How to find the connection. But I'm troubled because I'm not interested in the superficial joining and the warped uses of design, the use of design for the wrong purposes. I think designers have values and understanding that go beyond what ordinarily is understood in management organizations. But I'm looking for a bridge. I'm looking for a bridge because design is not a good enough bridge. I'm sorry. We love it. It's a great word for us. We can deal with it. We know its ambiguities. We know its richness, its diversity of meanings. But frankly, not a whole lot of other people in the world get it. They hear the word and misinterpret it. Or it slides away. It's going to go away soon. My guess is probably on a curve of about 8 to 10 years. We won't sweat that word so much anymore. Right now we're in a lively time. But I'm thinking, what word works more effectively? What concept do management and organization people have that captures what I understand in design? There surely must be something that crosses over. And finally, it did occur to me. There's a funny term that has a lot of baggage of its own that people misinterpret and misunderstand. And I'll say, when I tell it to you, you're going to misunderstand it too. I love you all, but you're going to misunderstand it. The term is entrepreneurship. the title of my lecture. I don't know there was a title up there. No, I guess not. I didn't give up. I don't use PowerPoint. So the title of this lecture is Design Entrepreneurship, the Convergence of Design and Management. The term is entrepreneurship, and I want to explain what this word is. Now listen to this as a definition of entrepreneurship, and you tell me if this matches your definition of design. Entrepreneurship is inventing an idea and developing it in an innovation that brings benefit to an organization and the people served by an organization. Invention and disposition. Our classic notions of design, discovering ideas, and working out the product implications, development through prototyping and so forth. That's their word for it. Now, sometimes people think it means starting small companies. No, it doesn't. It means starting new ideas and possibilities in any kind of organization. Sometimes new businesses, but sometimes existing organizations where you want to do something new. And contrary to popular belief, there are lots of organizations that want to do something new for more than simple profit. That's a hard one to swallow, isn't it? Oh, jeez. I've come to the land of the lions tear me apart now. Go ahead. here's the trick in this. Yeah, this is the trick you need to understand, because the folks who work in management and business, they aren't all that smart. They're pretty good. They're no smarter than you are. They don't know what they're doing any more than you do. And here's the funny thing. There are three great streams of design in the 20th century. One is engineering, and God love them, they do the best they can to make partial products. Engineers all think they make products. They don't. They make parts of products. They don't make a full, complete, total product as it is appropriate to the community of use and fits together. Peter's smiling, and we'll have a good conversation about this. Typically, engineers work on the logic and the usefulness of a product. But usability and desirability are features that are not often the attention of an engineer. When you find an engineer that can bring those together, you've got a very powerful combination. But typically, we bring together psychologists, anthropologists, designers, and engineers. So one great stream of design thinking in the 20th century that bursts into the 21st with great strength is engineering. And we know this. The second great stream is management itself. From the beginning of the 20th century, the explorations of management and organizational theory have been efforts to design better organizations. Every damn one of them. And I've read through a lot of the literature. You know, when you go into a dangerous environment and you don't know very much, you've got to work real hard and real fast to get up to speed. So I've spent a lot of time reading the literature that even some of my colleagues haven't bothered to read. And what I find repeatedly are elements of design thinking. Now, they're different notions of design. There's a great pluralism within the management community, and some of it is not very strong. But in essence, they're all looking for ways to make organizations better. The third great stream of design we know, the design arts, the arts that you know, that I know, that we practice, graphic design, visual communication, communication design, industrial design, product development, interaction design, and all of its growing family of forms, service design, and even the larger systems design issues. That stream of the design arts, and I use plural on it because there are so many, many pathways that we follow as professionals. These are the three great streams. And frankly, we find lots of organizations that are dominated by engineering. HP is just one of many examples. But we find a lot of interesting work that connects design now with design thinking. Design and management thinking together. They fit together somehow. We're starting to explore that with seriousness. And again, I think that the term entrepreneurship is a way forward. So if you want to make a difference in the world, one way is to understand how to work and use organizations, how to change them, how to make them. Because, frankly, the problem that animates me is the failure of organizations. All over the place, the failure of organizations. They're failing us. the greatest product of the 20th century has been the organization. Hey, I'm sorry, it's not airplanes, it's not cars, it's not computers. None of those would exist without the organizational structures that make them possible. Ford's understanding of the assembly line was decisive. It was a design concept, picked up in Europe, and brought back again. Without organizations, the inventions of designers have little impact. Bitter message. That's the truth. Would you rather have a designer at the helm of a large organization or someone else? I'd love to have someone there who understood what it is to have new ideas, wasn't afraid, someone willing to invest in developing new ideas, who valued design and had good purposes. Well, this brings me to our colleagues, and I've been speaking mostly to the group in Ethos, I think, but it brings me to my colleagues in COIN. Because if we're looking at collective, collaborative, innovative networks, that could be a definition of an organization. And I guess here's my comment on what I've seen in the conference up to now, and you have to bear with me from Ethos, because, no, actually, you need to know this, because it's kind of cool. We've seen a curious balancing of tech stuff, techie stuff, a lot of concern for software and how software can enhance or lead to a better understanding of networks, of communication, collaboration at a distance, where you presume, yes, collaboration at a distance, the possibilities for working together with people in other parts of the world. We've seen a lot of that technology stuff. But, you know, I was in a meeting with them and I said, boy, this all sounds like techie. And they went, oh, no, we actually mean so much more. And that was cool. I was glad of that. And I guess the alternative to the tech side is an understanding of what it is to have a face-to-face interaction. Now I'm going to try to take a leap, and I'd like you all to jump with me. We're going to try this, so I don't know if we're going to make it across that gap. When I talk with my MBA students and teach them design, I've got a process. You know, I have phases of work. You've got to understand the contextual research. You've got to explore the brief. You got to generate ideas and judge them, and you got to develop them a prototype, and I can tell you about that. But when I speak to other types of people, I say we're exploring the art of dialectic. Oh, bad word in the United States. You must not use the word dialectic. Oh, geez. Holy smoke. Best we can tolerate is rhetoric. No, but I'm telling you, we are knee-deep in a re-emergence of dialectic as a way of working together. Collaborative work. It's an art that's been rediscovered, guess where? In the schools of management. Late in the 20th century, a serious discovery of small group dynamics at MIT and other places, dealing with how we talk together and how we relate together. Dialogics is a word that's used sometimes, dialectic another. But essentially, how we take people with different opinions, have them come together and talk and discover things that they share in common that they might do, how they might work together. These are skills that come out of design in spades. Designers are great facilitators of conversations among people who have wildly different views about the world. That's a definition of a wicked problem, by the way. A wicked problem is where there are essentially contested values. Not accidentally contested, not arbitrarily contested, not accidentally contested, but essentially contested, meaning that there are fundamental differences that cannot be resolved. That to resolve them would be to violate the truths that have been discovered by different people. Designers work with wicked problems. They work with them by the use of dialectic, whether it's Gertian or Hegelian, or in fact, it's useful to know that there are three big kinds of dialectic. This will make you feel better. There is a materialist dialectic, and we call that Marxism sometimes. There is an idealist dialectic, and we call that Hegelian and Platonic. But there's a dialectic that we use in the United States and have from the very beginning of this country. It's called a skeptical dialectic. It's a dialectic of questioning. We ask each other questions and we listen to the answers and we keep asking back and forth till we come to some kind of agreement. Now, I got to tell you, we have fallen short of that art recently, but it's operating. Gosh, when I was in college, I had to read Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. Oh, dialectical materialism on the march. Bam, bam, bam. In the same class, we had to read Madison's Notes on the Constitutional Convention. A totally different kind of dialectic. They questioned each other about things. They talked together. Now, for me, I like the skeptical dialectic. I like the questioning and the talking together. And that's the art that designers are starting to use inside organizations, and it's very much related to the notions that COIN is developing. It's not just the network analysis, but what's the content of those conversations? What's the diffusion, not simply of words, but of understanding? Let me give you an example to make this more concrete. I've been interested in Banff. Banff is the great natural park in Canada. It's the greatest natural park in North America. Wonderful park. A few years ago, there was a huge conflict between developmentalists and conservationists. Never heard of that conflict, have you? Boy, it's all over the place. They're trying to rethink Banff. Banff is in some trouble. The park is going downhill. It's deteriorating. Say it's a natural park, yeah, but there are a lot of visitors. How can we think about changing Banff to accommodate some of the new changes in circumstances? How do we improve it to keep it from deteriorating into a wasteland, I suppose you'd say? Well, I suggested that maybe design would have a relevance. And my colleague, Eric Higgs, who was working at this, Eric brought this in. And at first, the developmentalists thought that design meant, oh, kind of touchy-feely, sentimental stuff. Conservationists were troubled. They thought it meant the Disneyfication of Banff. But as the work progressed, it happened this way. By focusing on individual projects and discussing what shall be done here and now, not with the meta theories of development and conservation, but what project can we agree on? Well, one project that they agreed on was where to move a path in the park. The path had to be moved about 200, 300 yards. And boy, they had been locked, irreconcilable. It shall not pass. Because they worried about the implications. But by using design, they were able to focus on the minute, the microstructure of the problem. And they could agree that, okay, well, we can do this, and it doesn't harm my conservationist idea, doesn't harm my developmentalist idea. They agreed to make that change. And I'm afraid that's the way it has to work for us in organizations in many cases. That by talking together and focusing on the small pathways of our experience, we can get through it. I guess I've got to add one feature on this that's really significant. I've got this theory, and it drives the systems thinkers crazy, because I think they really don't like me to say this. Because they like to talk about systems as if they really understand a system. But here's my notion. That it's impossible for a human being to experience a system. Not merely impossible, impossible by definition. Oh, and you can imagine that there are academics that don't like that idea at all, because they're very confident that they can understand systems. But my point is this. A system, by definition, is all that has happened, all that is happening, and all that will happen within a range of parameters. And only God knows about that. I've been around the sun 60 times in my life. 60 times. I've heard speculation about the solar system, and I actually enjoy astronomy a lot, and I do some studying, but all I really have experienced in the solar system are 60 circuits, well, a couple more than 60, circuits of the sun. And I'm afraid that people mistake their personal experience for the bigger sweep. They think that if you have the field equation, that you've understood the system. They think if you find the elements and define them, as Warren and Weaver have defined, that you understand the system. There's great danger in us thinking that. If we think we have understood the system, boy, the potential for unintended consequences is huge. And that's why, for me, as we work in organizations and work together in collective interactions, it's good that we start small with the pathways of individual experience. And slowly, out of the individual pathways, we knit them together into sustainable interactions, sustainable collective interactions. That's a deep driver for me. It motivates my work with MBA students. I don't know, I call them MBA students, but geez, they come from all sorts of areas. I've got two lawyers who are interested in this. They come to the capstone course in design that I teach at Weatherhead. My doctoral students are designers. They're learning some statistics, and they know some things about representation through numbers. That's not a bad thing. In fact, at that level, you kind of need that kind of work. I did a Myers-Briggs of the faculty at Carnegie Mellon when I was head. Did a Myers-Briggs. How many of you know what Myers-Briggs is? Oh, everyone. Jesus Christ, you all know. You all probably hate it. Designers hate that kind of shit. That's just terrible. Yeah. But you know, in the Myers-Briggs, you've got, we use the Kiersey variation. You've got NF, it's the intuitive feeling folks. And then you have NTs, the intuitive thinking folks, or the S's and so forth. But we found that, and I can give you the aggregate numbers, I won't tell you about individuals, but we found that essentially it was a 2-to-1 ratio of the NFs, the intuitive feeling faculty, 2-to-1 of the NT and ST, where thinking and judgment figures heavily in their work. Turns out their department head at the time was an INTJ, and one of the faculty members who has a wonderful firm in Pittsburgh was an ENTJ. There were a couple of others like this, but that was the spread. So now, after two runs of my capstone course of MBAs, take a guess what the distribution is. No, it's not 2-to-1 and NF to NT. It's 2-to-1 the other way. 2/3 are in the Myers-Briggs grouping of NT and ST. The T is big, and judgment is big. But 1/3 are in the NF. Very much like my faculty at Carnegie Mellon. Interesting balance. And I thought, my God, we have a lot of work to do to get these MBA students to have the more of the intuitive sensibility that makes design so wonderful. And I thought, holy smoke, what's wrong with this? What am I doing? We actually need people who are very careful for the kind of product that they make. The product they make, I want them to have a significant level of judgment and careful thought. Because, boy, when you design an organization, if you screw it up, you do a lot of damage to people. Well, this is maybe the kicker for you. At the beginning of the 20th century, when we talk about a product, we mean an artifact, a tangible good. Fast forward 100 years, the end of the 20th century, when we say product, we mean anything made by a human being. Anything made by a human being. So a policy, a law, a computer system, an environment, a natural park, these also are products. And what we bring as designers to help out with these collaborative, innovative networks, we bring that sensibility to human interaction. We see the organization differently. So this is not my apologia for moving over to Weatherhead. I'm not apologizing for that move, although I didn't bother to explain it to anyone because I was busy doing work, I guess. But it's good to be able to tell my friends in different areas now what that transition has been and what it's meant. So we are now building a joint program with the Cleveland Institute of Art, a master's program, because we want to see how more design students can have access to the services and the ways organizations work. It means a lot. But I suppose the best place to end this, and I know you're getting tired probably, it's been a long day, but I want to end on this point. We get real confused about the purposes of design. Why do we design? And then, when should we not design? How do we know what the ultimate purposes of design would be? Now, I know that the concerns for sustainability weigh heavily in your thinking about this. They're important to me, but I guess I rephrase them. I look at it differently. For me, the purpose is human dignity. What we can do to support human dignity. Treating people as people and not as things or as users or some other bullshit term like that. And I suppose dignity is to find our proper place in the world and not to exceed that place. So I might capture some of the same thoughts you have. But for me, I've got to pound out the work with the folks that make the decisions. And it's tough going, I'll tell you. We're doing projects with the Cleveland Clinic on patient and family experience. I've got three teams going over that group like crazy. We're dealing with a large international corporation. We're dealing with a local community college for student experience. We want to figure out how to make that better. Community colleges are in the news lately, you know. They're pretty serious these days. We're also doing a project with the Museum of Contemporary Art. We've got a range, for-profit, not-for-profit. We actually did a project with the Office of Sustainability with Cuyahoga County, so some government operation, too. So my interest in organizations is not just for-profit. In fact, that's kind of the focus at Weatherhead, not to commit to for-profit or not-for-profit. We just brought the Mandel Center for Nonprofits within the jurisdiction of the Weatherhead. Because we're very much concerned about how we work and organize nonprofit organizations. Here's what seems to have gone wrong in the business community. At least one of the things. Maybe it's the big thing. We've gotten confused over why you have an organization. Why do you have a business? Some smart asses think that it's about making profit. And I got to tell you, that's a battle to have within these walls. I work in the Gehry building. Frank Gehry designed an incredible building at the Weatherhead, and I live in that. But I find students who still think that organizations, businesses are about making profit. And I think this is an attitude that has grown up over the last 20 years or so, because it hasn't always been that way. In fact, there's a deep anchor in the literature of management and organizations that says that the purpose of organizations is to provide goods and services for people, to meet their needs and interests. And profit? Oh, profit's just a way of measuring and getting capital to do that work. But something's gone wrong in these organizations. They think profit is the end, and it's not. It's the means. That's a deep, wicked problem that I have to fight and my colleagues fight. But curiously, some senior people in respected organizations hear that message. So I'm not here to blow sunshine at you about the nature of the corporate world. There are a lot of sharks. They're not all sharks. There are some very decent people who want to do right. And that right is not defined by profit. These are tough matters to understand and think about. God, for a designer, it sort of stretches your head. But that's where we work. The dialectic of discovering what is good and serviceable for being human. So I set out as my task for this lecture to try to bring together two streams of thinking. One, design ethos in the various forms this means for Terry and for Cameron and for lots of you in the papers that you presented, in your own thoughts. And the second stream concerning network analysis, communication, the development of software and hardware, I suppose hardware to some extent, but software to understand those collective interactions, diffusion of knowledge and so forth. But also in that coin group, a recognition that face-to-face communication is a special thing. And to think that we understand it by doing network analysis, we've got to be very cautious about this. Humility is called for, because human beings do not experience systems.